Do you like comics? We're here to talk comics. This is the Superhuman Registration Podcast.
Yeah, I went to a work party yesterday, and it was movie day, and we just watched The Princess Bride, and it's like, the minute that the movie starts and you hear like the little sound effects of little Savage Boy playing the 8-bit baseball game on his Nintendo, it's like, oh, I'm going to recite this entire movie as it's playing, right? I'm not going to do that because I've got coworkers around me and I don't want to bother them. And then my coworker standing next to me starts reciting the movie.
Plato, Socrates, morons.
Can I confess something?
Oh, no.
I don't like The Princess Bride.
Well, it's been a good podcast, Steven. You want to check it up? I'll get the lights before we leave. And
no, yeah. No, John. This is now the podcast.
Oh, yeah.
Welcome to John and Steven Make Aldo Like The Princess Bride or Else. I'm your host, Steven. Our victim, Aldo, is going to listen all about why Fezzik is great.
The worst part is I know I should love it. Because I feel like I'm literally the only person in the room who ever doesn't.
No, that's an exaggeration. You're the only person on the planet who doesn't. What about when Rob Reiner had to leave the set when Billy Crystal started talking about MLTs, mutton lettuce and tomato sandwiches? Come on, man. You can't watch Miracle Max talking all mostly dead is partly alive. All dead, well, with all dead, there's only one thing you can do. Go through their clothes and look for loose change. You don't, not even a smile. That's not up your alley. I was so scared of the ROUSs as a kid, and then later like came back and I was like, that's a dude in a suit. What an idiot I was. It was an integral part of growing up, realizing that the scary, scary thing that made me run out of the room as a kid was a dude in a suit. Taught me a lot about life. Maybe a lot of the problems we have today are just dudes in suits. Uh-oh.
Oh, that was a horrid realization.
Oh, SpaghettiOs.
Seriously, Aldo, what's the deal?
I don't know. It just doesn't do it for me. You know how there's movies that like you flip into the TV channels and like you'll land on it, you know, back when we had TV channels?
Sure.
And
I'm an elder millennial. Go on.
Yeah. And like you know that movie's on and you're like, ooh, I'll just watch this. I'm already flipping through stuff, you know, it's halfway through, blah blah blah.
Smokey and the Bandit, always stop and put down the remote and watch the rest. Yes, go on.
Never has been that movie. Like I don't I could watch probably 90% of that movie with a straight face. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it just does not do it for me.
Is it one of those everyone in the world tells you how great it is and it makes you sick of it? Like, I didn't watch The Good Place for a couple of years because of that.
Probably. I think that's a part of it. I think it's the fact that every time I do say I don't like it, it turns into a witch hunt, except everybody knows who the witch is.
It's basically every time that I say I don't like it, this happens.
It's get me my steak this and grab your pitchfork that and do you want a peanut this and Cliffs of Insanity that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh, you're left-handed now? I'm fighting left-handed and I'm right-handed now. It's like, yeah, I get it. It's clever.
You think you know someone. I'm shook to my core.
I'm not. This Aldo's such a wet blanket. That's why he and I get along so well. This is me and Napoleon Dynamite.
Now, right.
I can't argue.
I was about to flip the table on that. I realized who I was for a moment.
I can't argue, Steven, like all of the points that you would bring up with Napoleon Dynamite, like poor production quality, it's a really dumb movie, but it tickles me.
I will say this about Napoleon Dynamite. I hated it the first five times I had to watch it. I think I like out of Stockholm Syndrome. Because when it came out and it was out on home media, everywhere you went, like it was playing in the background or somebody wanted to watch it. And it, for some reason, and for some reason, it was always somebody's first time watching that movie.
Because if someone hasn't seen this weird cultural phenomenon, you have to stop what you're doing and get them, you know, caught up to speed.
Yeah.
Because it was so weird. Yeah.
Yeah, I will say the thing that always makes me laugh, there's two things in that movie that always make me laugh. One of them is dumb. One of them is slightly less dumb. Is when they're doing the karate lessons and the guy slapping Kemp.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, exactly. That part. And then the part where, like, Napoleon's on the telephone and the cheese.
The pile of cheese keeps getting bigger.
Yeah, it just keeps getting bigger.
She probably has like 1,000 sticks in her drawer.
Like, for some reason, every time I watch that movie, that part, just watching the cheese every time the camera cuts, I'm just like, everybody's noticed it by now, but man, that still gets me.
I like the dude killing the cow in front of the busload of kids. Hi, yeah. Lyle. Yeah. I like my sister's rendition of Napoleon counting up his earnings from his awful day of helping out at the chicken ranch, where he's like, $6. It's like $1 an hour. It's as funny as it is in the movie. When my sister Lauren does it, it is hysterical. See, I was on an LDS mission in Russia, literally as far away on the globe as you can get from Utah before you're like coming back. We pulled out a globe and checked it one time. And everyone after a certain month who came over from the States was quoting this movie to me. And so I knew half the movie before I'd even seen it, because I didn't see it until I was back with my family. And I was like, all right, fine, let's see this thing. And I already like heard it. And like the first time I watched it, I was like, this is stupid. Why are we like, I'm never going to go to Idaho. Why would I ever? Why? No. And then the second time I watched it, I was like, actually, that is pretty funny. And then from then on, it was like every time I watched it, there was something new.
At some point, I think most people start out not liking that movie. And then at some point, Napoleon says, Tina, eat your food, you fat piece of lard.
Tina, and then you laugh. Lard, come get your dinner.
Yeah, and then you laugh for some reason. And you're like, I guess the movie's got me.
There's some movies you see just live in your head, whether you want them to or not. I don't know if you've ever watched Polka King on Netflix with Jack.
No, Black. I want to.
You should. I can't say it's a good movie. It's not a bad movie, but it is weird because it's all true, this story. I saw it at Sundance, and the producer came up and, like, you know, talked about how, no, this is really a real story, what happened, and it's the weirdest movie ever.
I will say the one movie that lives 100% rent-free in my mind 90% of the day is Kung Pao.
Here we go. We've had this conversation.
We have. I'm not going to reiterate it. I'm just going to point out that, like, you know, movies that live inside you, that one. Anytime that I'm drifting off into the nothingness, a quote will randomly pop up for the movie.
You should just drop a quote like that next time you talk to Evan. Just don't give him any warning and just be like, crap, man. And just watch his brain go, because he loves that.
There's nothing more evil than a tiny net. So dumb. Anyways.
I think I'm straining my brain trying to figure out how to segue from this to the topic of tonight's discussion. And I don't know a way to do it.
Here, I'll tell you. Diedrich Bader, who plays Rex of Rex Kwon Do, do you know he was also the voice of Batman on Batman Brave and the Bold? Bet you didn't know that.
Okay, so I actually did.
Diedrich Bader is actually one of my favorite Batman voices.
Yeah, he does a really good job.
He's not the best, but Kevin Conroy is my absolute favorite, yeah.
Yeah, but he's still like, I don't know, he's on the Mount Rushmore somewhere.
Yeah.
Brave and the Bold came out at probably the peak of my Luddite phase, when I was very tapped into pop culture, except for the fact that I didn't have a TV or a computer. So I didn't actually watch TV shows as they came out. I went to the DVD store on weekends after I got paid and would buy used DVDs and would watch. That's like why I watched the entire series of Gilmore Girls, because I was just buying the used DVDs. And
oh, man.
Batman the Brave and the Bold never got a good DVD release during this phase.
Oh.
So I just missed it. I missed the whole show.
It's good.
It's my favorite because that came out right. I mean, granted, that period of like super dark, super serious Batman stuff is still ongoing.
It's still going.
Yeah.
So it came out, at least for me, in like what was the perfect time, because I was really getting burnt out. I think it came out right around the time that like the Capullo Snyder run was wrapping up.
That sounds right. But I'm
and looking. Yeah, and like that was such a serious. It was a good run, but it was such a serious run, and I was burnt out on that. I was burnt out on all the Heath Ledger impressions. And just, it was, I think that was right before or right around the time that like the Zack Snyderverse was going to start happening and stuff like that. So it was like super dark Batman kind of peak time. And that show came out, and I know a lot of people didn't like it because it was so like goofy and silly. And for me, I was like, this is the Batman I love.
Because he teams up with all of these crazy, like the opening scene, it's always a in media res, like, you know, action sequence with some crazy character who would not otherwise get, you know, any amount of screen time. But I started showing it to my kids because I was like, I don't know, I think it'd be good for them to have an awareness of all these characters, and this is the easiest like entry into it, and it's fun, and I know it's not going to be too scary, you know. And it's good.
I love the episode with the Atom and Aquaman where they have to go into Batman's body, and Aquaman names a platelet. He just names it platelet, and it's his like, it's, you know, Batman blood companion. So he's writing it all over it, all over inside of him. And it's just like, come forth, platelet.
And it's John DiMaggio who does a great Aquaman. Yes, Aquaman.
And then in the later seasons, they started dropping a bunch of like musical episodes. So they had like the whole Music Meister, which is like an original to that show. They had the Birds of Prey episode, which I love, but also if I had been a kid, I probably still would have loved it and not gotten half the jokes in that. It's such a great show. Anyways, that's based on a comic book. And what do we read on this podcast? Comic books.
Hey. Indeed. We got there. Cool. Almost 15 minutes into recording and we finally get to the talk. Oh, boy.
Talk about burying the
good
lead.
Luck. So this is the Superhuman Registration Podcast, where we read a bunch of Marvel comics, talk about them, and then we compile them on this list of, you know, how much we like these comics. And we've got a lot of really good comics at the top of the list, and there are a lot of really bad comics at the bottom of the list. And depending on who you ask, we also have a lot of really bad comics at the top of the list and really good comics at the bottom of the list. But that's just the way this sort of thing goes. I'm excited to talk about the comics tonight because we got some fun ones.
Yeah.
It's been a while since we've had some fun ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got ghost dogs, and we got not ghost dogs who are also
flirty four. Snakes.
Yeah.
We got a kangaroo.
A surprising amount of animals in today's lineup.
J. Jonah Jackalson. I forget how they worked in Jackal, but he's a jackal.
Yeah, so anyway, not that those comics that we've been reading recently have been bad, just they've been bummers and
real
so tired.
Real thinking man books.
Yep. And I don't have very many good parts in my head to do the thinking with, so let's have some dumb fun. Yeah. Aldo, John, you guys doing okay this evening?
No. Yes.
I bought a Japanese pen, and it writes like butter on granite, which is a weird way to describe how it writes, but it's the best way I could explain it.
Is that good?
Yes.
Yeah.
It writes like real smoothly, but it also, like on paper, it still does like a little bit of a scratchy sound, which really tickles my brain, like, you know, curls. So I like it a lot.
I'm just sick. Okay. I have no interesting writing implements from far off countries and exotic locales. I have an iPad. End of sentence.
I just know that people get real like excited about like Japanese stationaries, and now I understand why.
But you only have half of that equation.
Oh, no, I have a Japanese notebook.
Okay, oh. There you go.
I was not listening. Apologies.
Well, I didn't mention it.
Oh, he waited to drop that other shoe.
Yeah.
I was just very excited about Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham.
Whoa. Do
we start with that?
I guess so. We started that.
I guess, yeah. We read Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham and Black Cat, both fairly new-ish comics. So, yeah. Let's get into Peter Porker first. John, why don't you start us off?
You like cartoons, kiddies? Gather around. You know how Spider-Man makes jokes and quips and things like that, and it's a part of his character, and something that most of the other superheroes and villains would notice about him? Imagine if we turned that up to 11 and made him not quirky and annoying, but full-on obnoxious. Also, he's a pig. That's Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham, written by Zeb Wells, artist is Will Robson, the colorist is Erica Arciniega, and letters, VCs Joe Caramagna. Sorry, I am not coronavirus, but some kind of awful sick right now. I don't know what yet. If I'm a little more than usual, that's why. We meet up with Spider-Ham in Earth 8311, and it is how many animal puns on superhero names can you make in one panel? Every single page that is set in this Earth is just chock full of them. He is annoying all of the other superheroes, talking about how he is a dimension-hopping traveler who spends time with multiverse versions of himself, saving the day, saving all these universes. And then he gets pulled into it and teams up with Spider-Man, our Spider-Man, the 616 Spider-Man, to try to figure out what's going on in his universe and how he can get back there also and save it from otherworldly intruders. Through a lot of weird jokes and the help of the Beyonder, who is a omnipotent bee who lives inside of his dimension-traveling wristwatch, they are able to get back. But oops, Peter Parker, real Peter Parker, is dragged along with him and is over it. It's very meta. They do several funny pages where we see literally behind the curtain whenever Spider-Ham is poking his head through a little bubble, giving commentary on splash pages for the rest of the book. We see what's happening behind that. I thought that was really funny. We'll talk about that more. Turns out it is Kang the Conqueror, but he's a kangaroo. They chase him around, and as they go from place to place, Spider-Ham is changed into slightly different styles of character. He kind of goes into the rubber hose animation from his, you know, generic cartoon style, you know, Tex Avery slapstick kind of stuff, and then he goes from there to the Batman the Dark Knight Returns as like a big buff Spider-Ham, and then back to himself. They confront Kang. Turns out Mojo is behind all of this. They turn the Kangs, all of the Council of Kangs, on Mojo, and everyone goes back home as they should. I thought this was wacky. The more I read it, the better I liked it. I thought it was stupid at first, and then I got that they were doing this stupid tone perfectly, and it worked for me after that. What did you all think?
I agree that I was not the biggest fan of it at the beginning. I also thought that this is dumb. This is going to be obnoxious. I have 4 more issues of this, and you are right. It gets better. It gets funnier. There is some, like, legitimate pathos for Spider-Ham himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it never really loses that goofiness, which is really fun. So I quite liked it.
Pretty similar. Like, I started and wasn't super into it, just because don't find Spider-Ham's, like, the way that they presented this character as being very ego-driven and very, like, full of himself and obnoxious and irritating to the other heroes, not in the way that Peter Parker is, where his jokes and his, you know, self-deprivation kind of get on their nerves, but the self-aggrandizement is what's bugging. Like, that doesn't quite ring true to me as a satire for Spider-Man. And yep. Then as the story kept going, I still wasn't super into it. Although I will say that it did get me. I am a pretty big fan of a well-done fourth wall break, and the weird little portal that lets Spider-Ham and Peter Parker look into the different issues and see plot developments before they happen. That was actually executed pretty well, and it requires some pretty clever writing. So yeah. I did appreciate that. By the end, like, there is, I think, a tonal shift where, like, again, this didn't, like, really win me over, but at the same time, I think it turns into a better, more worthwhile story than what we were getting at the beginning. And I think that's deliberate. I think they set it up to be one way with the intent of it paying off a different way. So, like, I don't want to speak to the, like, objective quality of the story. It just didn't really do it for me, but I appreciate what it was trying to do.
And to be fair, I do think the thing they got really well, kind of similar, this is going to be a weird comparison, a little similar to Edge of Tomorrow, where you start out really not liking the protagonist. You know, Tom Cruise and Spider-Ham, where you don't like them. You are not rooting for them. You are kind of like, oh man, I am as done with this character as everybody else is. And then at some point, you're kind of rooting for them. You're just like, hey, they're learning their lesson. They're doing the thing. And hey, you know, this is a character I can kind of get behind a little bit.
Yeah. I'm a fan of cartoons, and I'm glad to say that my kids are now requesting Looney Tunes and Tom and Jerry, and with one hand on a article online going through, like, what ones have been censored that should never be seen in today's world? You know, we go through and skip some of those. Thankfully, the streaming services have removed most of them, but I'm always like, oh boy, because a lot of the punchlines in some of these Looney Tunes is just the main character shrugging their shoulders and shooting themselves with a pistol, so that's not something that I really want my to see.
Jeez, what are they, persona protagonists?
as a lifetime cartoon fan, this tickled me. I like that the texture of like a newspaper comic strip is added to most of this. I like that it's all, you know, bright, crazy colors, and they, you know, admit that they're messing with, you know, physics, and like talk about, you know, in their fights how he convinces Kangaroo the Conqueror that he says, have you heard Spider-Man make one animal-based pun? No. Has he done any prop work, used a funny voice? Uh-uh. Right, the human brain barely works. The words that spill out of their mouths are utterly pointless. They have nothing to offer anyone anywhere at any time. So he's, knows that he's a silly cartoon character, is playing up the gags. That was fun for me. I think that the art is really solid throughout, and wherever the universe happens to be, and the things that they're parodying are interesting, the way that they're doing them. Yeah, it's silly, but once you accept that premise, like, hey, this is ridiculous, in that space of ridiculousness, they're doing really great stuff. You guys talk amongst yourself. I'm going to find all the animal names they pulled out, because they were just so many of them.
I do appreciate that Spider-Ham does have like actual character development, where, you know, like you said at the beginning of the show, he's very, you know, self-aggrandizing, he's very kind of arrogant, self-important, and it gets delivered to him pretty harshly that, you know, nobody likes him, everybody's annoyed and tired of him, and you get to see that kind of turn around on both ends, right? Like, you see the other characters as they are faced with a world without humor, that they kind of appreciate that Spider-Ham, for obnoxious as he is always kind of lighthearted, always making jokes and such. And Spider-Ham himself kind of realizes that he is grating on people and wearing their patience thin. And, you know, he goes through this journey trying to find a place to belong now that he feels like he doesn't belong. You know, that's why he's changing form every time he goes to one of these other, like, universes or places in time, I guess. So it's really kind of cool to see that in a book that could have just been silly 100% of the time, which, I mean, it pretty much is, but that did surprise me. I did not expect actual character development from a based Spider-Man character.
One who was bit by an old lady pig and turned into a pig.
Yeah, who was a spider.
He was originally a spider.
Yeah, a very human-looking spider, too, which is a little uncomforting.
And I think that might be a retcon. Like, that's definitely, I'm trying to make sense. He was created by Larry Hama, Tom DeFalco, and Mark Armstrong.
Larry Hama?
Uh-huh. He was the
Larry
editor.
Larry Hama created G.I. Joe.
Yeah. Larry Hama has done a lot of Marvel work. But Tom DeFalco was the writer and Mark Armstrong was the artist.
What a bizarre, wow.
Yeah, and now you know, Steven. And knowing is half the battle.
Oh, sorry. Yep, that's right. I was trying to make sense of when he's like bit by May Porker and then becomes the nephew or whatever. Like, yeah, born a spider, raised in the basement lab of May Porker. Okay.
Yeah, and then it's not really her nephew. It is like a roommate. Like, he points that out, which I thought was hilarious.
He's so obnoxious. Like, everyone's mad at him. It's, oh.
And that might be actually why this book got off to such a rough start, right? Is like, the first thing he does is disrespect this old lady who's taking care of him.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you're not supposed to like this character. But he does it in a way that's not particularly funny. Or it's like, yeah, you don't like him, but you want to keep seeing what he's doing, right? You just don't like him. So, I don't know. That's, I don't want to read about people being mean to old ladies.
But I do want to read about Sand Manatee and Dr. Doom.
I do love that the character pun names are based on the actual names and not like the character, if that makes sense.
What do you mean? Like Captain Americat?
Yeah, like that. Like the fact that Dr. Octopus, I think, is not an octopus, right? I think
he's Dr. Octopussy Cat.
Yeah, exactly. So he's not based on an octopus. He's a cat.
Yeah.
Yes.
Like, that's what I mean. It's like,
Cloak is just Croak. He's a frog. This is delightful. Come on, Steven.
Okay, here it is. Here's the reason I didn't like this. I spent so long staring at the animal Thor, trying to figure out what the heck they could have done.
He's as a like dog, a, isn't a he? Pun name.
Thur, like Gurr.
His name is Thur. I got so mad. It's like, how am I supposed to figure that out?
It's delightful.
How happy John is so happy about this.
I can't argue that it's not dumb. You know, this is very Napoleon Dynamite adjacent, where like it's dumb, but let's get beyond that and look at how funny the dumb is, you know? So
it took me until like issue 5 to get what the Avengers team name was supposed to be. Like Ska-Vengers? What Scavengers? I hate it.
You were looking for trumpets and dance circles, and you couldn't find them. I'm just gonna be Goose Rider. Am I right?
Anyway,
I did think it was funny. This is not really related a whole lot to the book, but I did think it was funny that Iron Man is called Iron Mouse, and I got a laugh out of that because there is a very popular VTuber who was named Iron Mouse. And I had to send screenshots to my buddy, who is also a fan. I was like, hey, do you think they're also Puerto Rican?
I laugh. I don't know. More. I don't know Iron Mouse, the VTuber.
Mojo also makes fun of...
Family Guy.
He makes fun of Joker by trying to make...
That took me a minute and a half to understand what that Spider-Man reference was.
Yeah.
When he was dancing and doing that stuff, and I kept staring at it. I was like, I know this is something I've seen.
It was Joker.
Yes.
Yeah. Put on a spidey face.
Yeah. Yep, the Joaquin Phoenix Joker.
Oh, man. I didn't get it until just now. That's dumb.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the point.
It's dumb here, and it's dumb in universe, too.
Yeah, and it's dumb in real life, and in the movie, and everything. I'm sure it's a movie a lot of people would consider it's a great movie. I'm not sure I want to associate with the people who would say it's a great movie.
Yeah, everyone who I've seen, they're like, it's good, but I'm never going to watch it again. And it's like, huh, well, maybe I can skip it. But
I'm still curious. Yeah, I'm actually curious about watching that one, mostly because it's not like a sequel. It's a different version retelling. So like that has me a little intrigued.
It's getting a sequel.
I think Lady Gaga is Harley Quinn in that.
Lady Gaga, indeed.
But yeah, I don't know. It's not like a direct sequel. It's like, I mean, using the same actor and stuff, but it's supposed to be like a different story. Like, I don't think it's supposed to be a sequel.
Well, I mean...
Oh, they shouldn't call it Joker 2, then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the distinction is if it's not. It is the next chapter of his story because it takes place after... I don't know.
Does it?
Your take here.
Because what I heard, this was a while back, I haven't kept up with the news on it, but that it was supposed to be like the same actors, but it's not the same Joker.
Well, it's called Joker Folie à Deux.
And I think it has the same director, and it has...
Yeah.
I'm looking at IMDb, no joke, Aldo, as if the universe is conspiring to prove you wrong.
That's fair. The synopsis
just says sequel to the film Joker from 2019. I'm sorry, like, I would like them to start making movies that just, oh, this is a Joker movie, but don't worry, it's not so closely tied to the last one that we're limited in our storytelling and what we can do with this character. That would be great if we could have, you know, a million Star Wars stories that aren't linked to just the rebellion and the Empire and that whole era and somebody named Skywalker. That'd be great, but that's not the world we live in. This is actually, sorry.
Okay, I mean, I'll accept that. I'm not married to it, like, it's fine, but whatever.
Lady Gaga. Anyway.
Yeah. Apparently Ken Lung? Is that the same Ken Lung I think it is? That's...
Uh-huh. Community and a lot of other things, but so I know him.
I don't think we're thinking about the same Ken
Lung. Oh, no. Ken Jeong is, yeah. You said, yeah. I like, his face is in front of me. And I'm like, yeah, Ken Leung, who's in a million things like Rush Hour and Lost. And then my brain skipped over that and was like, Ken Jeong, he's funny. He's in a Joker movie.
I think that says a lot more about you than you wanted to say, John.
Yeah. I'm going to go. It's more like a typo. It's more like a typo thing instead of a stupid... It's more of a stupidity thing.
Oh, he's the guy. Hold on. No, this is funny. This is also completely unrelated to everything. But I think he revealed in an interview like not too long ago that when he auditioned for the Avatar live action, because he's Commander Zhao, he thought he was auditioning for Blue Avatar, not Airbender Avatar.
Oh, jeez.
Oh, no.
See, anyone can make mistakes, Aldo.
It's so
hilarious. Some people audition for the wrong franchise. Some people think that the Joker sequel isn't.
Yeah, some people think Ken Lung and Ken Jeong are the same person.
I don't know who either of them are, so there.
I'm so sick right now. Listen. I did see a really interesting YouTube short where someone was talking about, and I do not know where this particular YouTuber is from, but they were saying, oh, people are complaining that there's no diversity in this new Avatar remake. And I was like, why complain about it any more than why are they remaking it at all? Because it was perfect in anime. Anyway, but he pointed out there are actors in here from, and he listed off all these different countries. And it's like, oh, diversity is only when it's like black and white actors and Latino actors, Hispanic actors, and Asian actors all together. Like, you can have diversity with all black actors. You can have diversity with an all Asian cast. And that's what they've done here. So, like, I thought that was a good distinction to be aware of. So,
I think there is a reason to have a live action Avatar. I haven't seen the Netflix version yet. I don't think that one has the reason for it.
I think there is a reason. I don't know that anybody knows what it is yet because money. They don't get it right.
I just think that you can and maybe like you should, but not. This ain't it, Chief.
But your scientists were so preoccupied with whether they could or not. They could. I'm so sick, I can't even quote Jeff Goldblum. Oh, guys, I'm not feeling good.
You're so sick that we can't even stay on topic.
That's not new. Don't blame this on the illness. Yeah, let's talk about Black Cat then. And
wait, hold on. I have one more thing I want to say about...
Oh, sorry.
Spider-Ham. Back on topic, I guess. Your wet blanket, Steven. Is that I like the art. I thought the art was cute, it was colorful, it was very much in tone. I do wish that when they had switched up styles, I wish they would have committed a little bit more to it. Like the Dark Knight Rises parody, like that was fine. But when he went to like Rubber Hose animation, I wish a little bit more of the world and maybe a little bit more of like Spider-Ham's like outlines and stuff like that kind of reflected that a little bit more. That's it. That's all I had to say.
Could have played around more with that, sure.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That would have been nice to see, but it is what it is, and it's fine. It's fine.
The stylistic change was like weirdly hampered by the story because the only thing that really changed was Peter Porker himself, right? Because Peter Parker doesn't change. It's Spider-Ham's insecurity. I don't know. I see what you're saying, but I also feel like they were kind of constrained by the storytelling choices that they made on how far they could lean into it.
Sure.
The over-the-top narration box is pretty funny, though, I gotta say.
Mm-hmm. I did like that fourth wall break. That was really well done. It reminded me of, what was that other one? Was it Gleep? Glorp? Whatever the heck that Slimer-looking guy is.
Dupe.
There it is.
Oh, I don't like Dupe.
Gleep.
Yeah, I do like this kind of between the panels joke a lot better than it was in there.
Yeah, they're different, but I see why you're making that connection.
Yeah, they're different in that this one was better.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like that we got off on so many tangents because I don't know that there's actually that much to say about this story.
There's not.
There really isn't. It's fine.
It's okay.
It's fine.
They can't all be winners.
They don't have to be either. Like I feel like a bit of a hypocrite because I always beat the drum over the importance of having kind of just like stories that are fine. They don't all have to change the world. They don't all have to completely rewrite the way you think about fiction or life. Sometimes you just need good stories because just the solid stories are so important for the really good stories to land with the impact that they need to have, right? And then when we get one of them, I'm just like, oh, there's nothing to say about this. It's just dumb.
Well, that's the thing, though, right? Is that like, and I mean, I think that's the trend of this podcast. Is like, if it's really good, there's not much else to say because we're all in agreement that, hey, this is really good. And when you have like a book that's so kind of inconsequential and innocent and inoffensive, it's like, yep, this was a book. This was a good book. I did not hate my time with it.
Yeah.
It didn't do anything groundbreaking. It didn't need to. It didn't do anything like revolutionary to the character. Again, it didn't need to. This is a fine book. This is a solid 5.0.
Polygon had an article today about the death of the filler episode that I thought was really interesting. Speaking of Avatar, where they mentioned, or the article discussed the idea that part of the genius of Avatar The Last Airbender was its episodic format, where they had, you know, 22 episode seasons or 24 episode seasons, and each episode like progressed the story sort of, but it wasn't really always about progressing the story. Sometimes it was just about giving the characters space to be around each other, so that way you saw their relationships develop, and then when you had those moments where their relationships were tested, those moments meant something. And similarly, you know, they were making progress a little bit. And so when you got to an episode where the status quo really changed, you really felt it because there was a status quo to be disrupted.
Yeah.
And in the era of the streaming service, we've kind of gotten away from that. Like Avatar, the Netflix show, is 8 episodes. There's no filler. It's just progression the entire time. And so you don't have those story beats. So I guess what I'm saying is, thank goodness for stories like Peter Porker, the Spectacular Spider-Ham, because they make stories like Into the Spider-Verse or Secret Wars or whatever else land harder, because you need stories like this to make those other ones meaningful.
Yes.
Anyway, the Polygon article was really good. I recommend it.
Read that instead of this book.
I'd like to read that because I feel like, yeah, when you're binging, and that's the way a lot of people will watch shows, they just want to see, you know, payoff. And it feels like your time is wasted when you watch a million episodes and one episode is just, you know, a bottle episode. Like, oh, you know, I binged Lost back in the day and there's a whole episode about Jack's tattoos. That was stupid. But if it had been something good, it would have been okay. You know, where it's like, we get a little bit more information about a character.
Yeah, on that note, I do kind of miss, like 20 plus episode animes and stuff like that, because they had a lot more downtime. Where like nowadays you have a ton of like 12 episode seasons and anime and stuff like that, and it's like, you know, it's 20 something minutes of plot, less than that really, and it's just kind of progression. So anime could use more Spider-Ham, I guess.
Bring back filler episodes.
Yeah, I hate how much people hate filler episodes. Like it's like, it's a waste of time. Like, it's really not if it's entertaining. But I guess that's the caveat, though, right? Is it has to be entertaining. Is it has to be good.
I'm skipping all the One Piece filler episodes.
Well, then.
My time is precious.
Should we move on? Hey, listen, if your time was precious, you wouldn't have started One Piece.
I was going to say, I was like, I have given up.
yeah, I think it's time to move on. Aldo, you're up with Black
Cat. Black Cat. We read Black Cat from the 2019 run, the first 5 issues. Story by Jed McKay. I guess I could have done art first. Art by Travel Foreman. And there's a few guest writers and artists at the end of each, or the first few issues. I keep wanting to say episodes because we're talking so much about television. Colors. The color artist was Brian Reber. Letters by Farron Delgado. And that's about it. I was going to say editor, but we never say the editor. Nick Lowe. There you go. You get one. So this is the beginning to kind of like a longer story. There's like a 12-issue run. We read the first 5 issues because it's within the first trade. The first trade is also called Grand Theft Marvel. So I don't know. I don't know if that means anything. But this is a story about Black Cat kind of doing her own non-Spider-Man related stuff. This relates to her relationship with the Thieves Guild in New York, which she is not on very good terms with. Odessa, the current leader of it, kind of has it out for her, and I think wants to kill her, or at least wants to get some money out of her because she hasn't really been paying her dues. And while this kind of situation is happening, she is approached by her old mentor, the Black Fox, who has stolen from Dracula in the past. And that is pretty cool because he's just a dude. He has no powers. He's just a regular geriatric old man. And he has kind of reached out to Black Cat and her crew to do one last heist on the Thieves Guild. Specifically, he wants to steal from the giant money deposit that they have, from all the money that they collect from all the thieves, which apparently seems like quite a bit. A little bit of a John Wick situation, from my understanding. And so he tasks Black Canary crew to start stealing a couple things, not very luxurious looking things. He has them steal the deed to Manhattan from Doctor Strange, where when they go into his house, they have, oh, I forgot his name, something the Merciless. Do you guys remember the name?
Oh,
Xander.
Oh,
Xander. Yeah, Xander the Merciless, who is attuned, who was designed and made by like something like 16 magic masters or some magical BS to be attuned to Doctor Strange. So that's why they've hired him. And they call them Merlins every time like thieves need to hire some sort of magic. They call that Merlin. Like you have to Merlin for them or whatever. That's hilarious. So they hire him and he kind of helps them get in there and, you know, navigate to this trophy room. While they're there, they meet a ghost dog named Bat. They meet two very flirtatious snakes and they find all of the discarded dreams and thoughts and whatever in of Stephen Strange in little like head forms. And Xander goes haywire. He finds like the Soul Stone, Star Stone, whatever magical BS item. I didn't take notes if you can't tell. And he goes crazy and starts attacking the crew. They escape. They trick the dog into thinking Black Cat is Silver Sable. And he's a big fan, apparently. Not a big enough fan to know what she actually looks like, but, you know, whatever. And gets them out. Stephen Strange comes back and he's like, what happened to my house? And the dog is like, we're just dumb animals here. Their next job is they have to steal a book, like a magic book from the Fantastic Four. Instead of like heisting in there all sneaky like, Black Cat just kind of invites Johnny Storm on a dinner date. And they go in there and they are attacked, like a portal to another dimension is open while they're in the Baxter building. And they kind of have to become heroes, her and her crew, and they fight this annihilator monster thing from another dimension and they defeat him and send him back into his world. And Sue Storm arrives home and she's very mad and she leaves. And I think they did get the book. There was a confirmation on that. Yeah. So they get the book. While all this is happening, there's a lot happening in this book, by the way. I don't know if you guys noticed that. It does a pretty good job at weaving all this stuff in. There is another guy, Ocampo, who was like a security at Odessa's in the first issue where she steals a painting. I didn't mention that. I am now. And loses his job because he accidentally let Black Cat and her crew get away with his painting. So Odessa hires him to track her down. So this whole time he's kind of also hunting for her, interrupts with this whole Johnny Storm thing, which is how her crew ends up in the building and kind of fights alongside them. And it's kind of paid off by Black Cat at the end of this story to leave Odessa. I do believe he comes back later, but for this issue, he doesn't really have an alliance anymore by the end of the book. What did you guys think?
This one, again, I was like, all right, we're going to do Black Cat. Like, how is this going to be, you know, more than just a Marvel take on Catwoman or whatever? Really liked it. We're just talking about the kerfuffle at Yancey Street. I forget what the name of the two-parter is. The Yancey Street Shuffle, excuse me. And how the other dimensional visitor or whatever just is holding up her crew member who's in a thing suit. And he's like, astounding, no powers, no abilities, just that pathetic suit. And yet you faced me in battle and did not run. What are you? And the guy spits blood in his eye and says, me? I'm from Pittsburgh, pal. I thought that was fun. And, like, if it was in a movie, it might be obnoxious, but it's, a lot of this is, you know, we see a regular gentleman thief steal from Dracula, who could have killed him, he says, anytime he wanted to. We see Felicia Hardy breaks into the Baxter building, into the Sanctum Sanctorum, and we see, you know, these superheroes are arrogant when they forget that, you know, regular old people, you know, Felicia Hardy does have some powers, but just a criminal crew with enough skills, you know, can get past, all, you know, you have your snakes and your ghost dog guarding. Well, that's not going to be good enough if they get charmed by the intruders or just straight up lied to. Yeah, I'm Silver Sable. What's up? Yeah, that's how Silver Sable does it the whole time. I really liked it. I thought I liked the art better and better as it went on. I think it was the same artist the whole time.
Yeah.
And just covers mostly by well, like what you would expect for a Black Cat book is a J. Scott Campbell cover, you know. But, you know, she's like, there's some just great moments where, like, you pretty one, you please me, you'll be my Earthway. Well, that's just great. Like, there's just some great little moments where you know, she's up against it and still manages to come out. I don't know. I like heist movies. I like heist stories. And so this worked for me. And I wasn't expecting much.
Yeah, I did like the part where that I'm looking up what the guy's name is because I can't just keep referring him to the interdimensional dude.
It's like Blastar or something.
Yeah, Blastar or something like that. Yeah.
Yeah, Blastar.
It is Blastar.
That's right. It is Blastar.
Yeah, so when Blastar shows up and they're running towards him to like the negative zone portal or whatever, and Johnny Storm is running in front of her and she's kind of philosophizing about like, yeah, you don't date a guy like Johnny Storm. He's nice. He's innocent, blah, blah, blah. He's like, she's like, that's not what I like. I, you know, she's kind of talking about her preferences in men and essentially her life. And the shot is like him running ahead of her. And she's like, I do like the view in here though. Yeah. Objectify Johnny Storm.
Yeah. I had two competing thoughts like going through my head the entire time that I was reading this story. One, this is really derivative. I feel like I've read all of this before. Like a lot of Marvel comics in this era seem to have a very similar sort of tone where it's fun and jaunty and not taking itself too seriously and a little bit self-aware and like all of that. I feel like I've read all of this before. Plus, like John said, Black Cat is very much a Catwoman pastiche, like it's the same character. Mm-hmm. So that was one thought. It's like, I've read all of this before. The other thought is, I'm having fun. This, I genuinely actually quite liked this story. It's great because the bulk of my understanding of the character of Black Cat comes from a lot of those early Spider-Man stories where she is just flirting with Peter Parker. She's just like, it is just Catwoman flirting with Batman, right? And yeah. The character has definitely taken some different directions since then, but this is Spider-Man's Catwoman, just like Green Goblin is Spider-Man's Joker. I didn't know anything else to the character. This story makes Felicia Hardy her own character. She has personality. She has depth. It is still basically just Selena Kyle, but some of the solo Catwoman stories are really good. This is really good, and it leans into Marvel Comics wackiness the way that Catwoman never really gets into the weirdness of the DC universe.
Mm-hmm.
Not really.
Yeah.
She is too caught up in like the Batman noir world to really have a moment where she goes toe-to-toe with Lobo, you know, some other like wacky extra-dimensional creature. Felicia Hardy going up against Blastar and, you know, that's not something that you would see in a Catwoman comic. Felicia Hardy getting mistaken for Silver Sable, that was the funniest thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, who's Silver? Nobody knows who Silver Sable. I do because I had the trading card, but that's it.
I do because she was featured in the Spider-Man video game.
Oh, yes, she would be in the Spider-Man video game.
She's in a Spider-Man comic where it's cloned Ben Reilly Spider-Man. And I forget his, like, spider name, and it's ridiculous. That's the only reason why I know who that is, but...
Black Cat has been having a sort of renaissance in the comics recently, starting with this book, right? Like, there was, a very strong initiative to make her into her own character, and they've gone, like, a very different route, kind of pretty, like, counter to Black Cat, or to Catwoman in the DC stuff, where in the DC stuff, Catwoman has, you know, married and really partnered up with Batman. Whereas in the books here, they've really kind of played into the idea that she's, you know, for lack of a better term, she's the other girl in Spider-Man's life. And she's kind of come to terms with that, or she's trying to kind of come to terms with what it means for her to be like a thief, kind of being a rogue, not necessarily a villain or a bad guy, but also not necessarily a hero, and like what that means for her and her lifestyle and stuff. And so they've been doing a lot of that recently. We saw a little bit of that in the Black Cat Mary Jane book, right? Where they're talking at the end, and she's talking about how, you know, Mary Jane will always be number one, and she's always going to be number two. She's never going to be Spider-Man's, you know, main girlfriend or wife or anything like that because of the relationship. But even if she could be, she probably doesn't want to do that. That's not who she is. So they've really kind of started developing her and kind of given her a stronger identity other than Spider-Man's side piece, which, again, probably a better way to phrase that, but I'm not looking for it.
It's not entirely inaccurate, unfortunately, because again, that's the impression of the character that I had is just she's the one who's in Spider-Man's orbit and isn't interesting in her own right. And it turns out, no, she kind of can be.
Yeah. And so, like, I like what they've done with these books, and especially like this run. And then after the King in Black, they kind of restarted her run. And that book starts out with her having to steal Doctor Strange from Null's prisons. So she has to heist out a whole Doctor Strange. But a lot of these books have been about her past, who she is, what are her wants and needs, and what does she think about stuff. And it's been really interesting. I think this run, specifically this first 12-issue run, does a really good job at kind of her coming to terms about her relationship with the Black Fox, kind of being a pseudo-father figure. You know, we see in here, I didn't go a whole lot over it, but Black Fox was her mentor who bailed her out of prison and then trained her to become a thief. And he had previously done that with her father. And so there's, you know, the sort of familial father figure part of his, like that's his role in the book. So I think there's like a lot of interesting stuff. And I do think it gets a lot better as like you keep going through the series. I read these in the single issues as they were coming out. Like I have these and I quite like them. So especially these first ones were just kind of a fun couple of heists. You know, there's talking snakes, there's the ghost dog, there's just all this weird, silly stuff.
Batson is the best.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The Dr. Boris, the nerdy guy that's on her crew. She had a crew. I didn't mention the two guys. It's Bruno Granger, who's the big dude who went toe-to-toe with Blastar. And Dr. Boris Corpse, who is like the science guy on the team. And his whole shtick about not believing in magic and probability. Like, it's all probability. It's all manipulation of, you know, antimatter and blah, blah, blah.
And it pays off. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, Dr. go ahead. Take it over.
Did not expect to like Bruno and Dr. Corpse, but holy crap. Those characters were great. Bruno, like, as the muscle, is kind of just like, whatever. There are characters like this all over. It took me a while to realize, no, this isn't a character from The Enforcers, even though I could have sworn it was one of The Enforcers. It wasn't. But, like, the moment when he, like, gets ready to go toe-to-toe with Blastar and Black Cat just kind of, like, kisses him on the side of the head and says, don't die. It's like, hey, this is actually really sweet and really charming. I like the rapport that she has with her crew. And then freaking Dr. Corpse in the middle of the magic mansion, whatever Dr. Strange calls this stupid house, Sanctum Sanctorum. He's like, I don't believe in magic. Magic is just, no. And it just reads like this really ridiculous moment until he happens to mention, it's all just like untapped probability fields. And that just rings the bell in Felicia Hardy's head, where she's like, oh, it's about probability? I'm a probability power person. I'm going to mess with, like, I don't know. It worked. It was cool. They had good rapport as characters. They had depth and personality. They weren't just cliches. The crew really, I think, is what puts this book over the top for me, from being just like, oh, this is fun too. Oh, this is fun.
Yeah. And while, I mean, you can basically boil both of these crew members down to like a single sentence, they have a surprising amount of personality, right? Like Dr. Corpse has, like he talks about, you know, he's a fan of these scientists. He had to make his own poster of one of them because, you know, there's no posters for that guy. Boris loves Elvis. He has two Elvis tapes in the van that they listen to. And I think that's what he was going to play on the vinyl when Felicia was like, no, not again. Yeah. Like, they have a surprising amount of personality. Not a lot of backstory that we know of, which you don't need it all the time. This is her book, right? It's Felicia. It's Black Cat, the book. It's not Black Cat and her crew.
They're like the guys in Scott Lang's security company in the Ant-Man.
Exactly. Yeah. They're perfect. Great. They're fun. They're good characters. And I love that they're, you know, at least seemingly loyal. As, you know, as Dr. Corpse says, as long as the heists bring in money. But they're loyal and they have this like great rapport and you can really feel it, right? Like you mentioned that bit where she's gonna, when she leaves Boris behind and he's like, trust me and whatever. And she talks about, you know, trusting your crew. They have to have your back and you have to have theirs and stuff like that. It's like really great. And the fact that like when they defeat Blastar and she sends him back into his dimension with the Fantastic Four car jet thing. And she's like, tell him Black Cat or crew sent you. It's like, that's great.
Yeah. Good. It was good.
They could have, because, you know, yes, this is a lot of familiar things, but the one, you know, these henchmen having personalities beyond just, yeah, boss, okay, boss, and her caring about them was very refreshing, very different.
Yeah.
Take on the normal, like, I'm the pretty girl thief and you're going to do what I say, see? And, like, it was really fun.
Yeah. And there is, like, a great thing about her kind of personality in here, right? Because she cares about her crew, obviously. And Ocampo, the dude that she kind of screwed over by stealing the painting, kind of tells her that, hey, you only care about people enough to use them, and then you don't care to live to, like, pick up the pieces after you destroy their lives or whatever. Which is something that, you know, as a thief, probably something that happens a lot, right? But she has that realization that that's what she does to people. And I think part of it, and I don't know if it plays into the her crew, but I think, like, that is a turning point for her and the way she treats others. And kind of, I think that does circle back into the way that she has been kind of using the Thieves Guild. Which, you know, granted, the Thieves Guild also is not the most friendly place, so maybe kind of sort of justified, I can't remember. But there is something there, right, that we do, or we will see kind of later playing a little bit more to her story and her character.
We need to come back to this series at some point.
I kept reading. I never keep reading, like, right when it's, you know, because I'm always like, oh, I'll come back. And sometimes I do come back at another point, but, like, this time I just kept right on through. I'm, like, two issues ahead of what we read today, and it continues to be real fun.
Yeah, they're really good books. I really enjoyed both these two, like this one and the follow-up to it.
Art. I want to talk about the art real quick. Y'all ever read the webcomic Girl Genius?
Once or twice.
It has been one of my favorites. It's one that I will, like, read it from the beginning, get caught up on it, and then let it lie fallow for a year or two, and then go back and read it again. It's such a slow-moving story that updates every Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and has been since, oh gosh, it's got to have been running for almost 20, 25 years now.
Dang.
Yeah. Again, I miss webcomics. At the same time, one of my favorite comics is a webcomic that I don't actually read regularly. But anyway, Girl Genius is interesting to me because the artists... Phil and Kaya Folio are the creators. And they are both artists in their own right. And they have very similar styles. And I actually can't remember right now. I think Kaya is the one who does the art. They like drawing very sexy, curvaceous women. Not in, like, a pinup sort of way, but just like, oh, these are very clearly attractive women doing, you know, funny stuff. They draw, their main character is a woman named Agatha. She is very curvy, very busty, and often winds up running around in her underwear. But it's like a steampunk thing, so her underwear is like a lacy top and bloomers. So it's a little bit sexy, but never, like, into the territory where you would be embarrassed to have somebody walk in and watch you reading it. The reason that I bring this up is because I feel like, weirdly, this portrayal of Black Cat walks a very similar line. And I'm thinking of that moment specifically where, you know, Dr. Corpse is talking about probability, like magic is just, you know, manipulated probability or whatever. And Black Cat has the realization that, oh, my powers can mess with this stuff. There's this shot where Black Cat is kind of in the traditional villain power pose for a sexy character, where she's like leaning over, her kind of low cut cat suit is plunging a little bit, so you can definitely see a lot of her chest. But then you look at her face, and her face is just gleefully maniacal. It's a character who is incidentally sexy, but the cartooning, the art, is far more interested in portraying this character than it is in portraying the sexiness. And it just happens to be a pose that could be taken as sexy because it is so revealing. But, like, I don't know, my eyes are not drawn to her chest. They're drawn to just this maniacal grin on her face. And I love it. It's that willingness to be sexy, but never at the expense of the story you're trying to tell, where you're willing to slap a goofy face on a sexy body. I love it. I actually think that's really cool. And I don't know. It was a weird parallel that popped into my head when I was reading this book. And I just think the art is great. The characters are portrayed really well. The sexiness is there and never, never overwhelming. It's just there. It's great.
Yeah. I think there's something, like, really good about the art here. One of the things I wanted to point out To your point, Stephen, one of the things I like is that most of the cheesecake-ness factor that plays into Black Cat is kind of only on the covers.
Right?
Yeah. So, which, you know, a little misleading. That will always 100% be my number one complaint with comics. But that the cover is not always indicative of what's inside, but that's fine.
Yep.
If you're doing a Black Cat comic, I can't really think of somebody else that you would want to sell your book more than like J. Scott Campbell.
Right. Yeah.
So like that makes sense. But one of the things I like a lot about the book and the art specifically is that her suit 90% of the time is drawn as just straight black. Like there is no like details in it. It is just a silhouette. And there's a couple parts, I think it's when they go back to the hideout after they steal the painting. Like, there are some highlights on her body just to separate her from, like, the couch that she's going to sit on. Because her suit is just, like, always just, like, this kind of black suit. So, like, they don't even allow, the art isn't even allowed to, like, do the lines that would, you know, imply, you know, more cleavage or hips or butt or anything like that, right? So, like, that's not important to the art. And it plays to its strength, kind of like you mentioned, because even though she is showing like a little bit more cleavage in that shot, there's not a lot of detailing going on the suit to like carry that idea forward.
I was relieved that they downplayed that.
Yeah, which is like a real nice change for a lot of these hero books, right? Like we have stopped complaining about that as much as, you know, we've kept doing the podcast so long, but go back to like any of our first or even second year episodes, right? And what was like a consistent complaint that we have about female characters, right?
Always the cheesecake.
Always the cheesecake, yeah. And here, you know, a sexy character who is sexy because like that's what she plays into, like that is what her character does, but not like the cameras and the art don't force it.
Yeah. Again, this was a fun jaunt. I don't know that I have anything. Again, I don't think this is an all-timer. This is definitely closer to the filler end of the spectrum than the, you know, status quo shattering story. But, like, now, if you read a story where, you know, Bruno pulls a gun on Dr. Corpse and shoots him, it's going to be terrifying. You're going to be like, no, I love those guys, right? It does the thing that these sorts of comics are supposed to do. Gives these characters time to spend together to express their personalities. Yes, you've got plot that's progressing, but you're less concerned about the plot than you are about the fun that you're having along the way.
Speaking of the spectrum, any ideas where they belong on our list?
Ooh, I like it. Yeah, let's take a look at the list and find out. Currently on our list, we have 273 stories. That number is creeping and creeping and creeping. So these are both Spider-Man adjacent stories, and we've talked Spider-Man a lot. The very first story that my eyes fell on that is a Spider-Man story is Spider-Man Noir, which is currently at number 97. We also have, I mean, Spider-Man's overrepresented in the top of our list because he's one of the best comic book characters of all time. He's overrepresented at the bottom of the list as well because he's had some of just the worst stinker stories ever. He's also overrepresented in the middle of the list because we read a lot of Spider-Man stuff. Neither of the stories are really about Spider-Man, though. Let's start with Peter Porker, The Spectacular Spider-Ham. Where do we rank it?
So, I liked it, but I think I'm the minority opinion here. I will point out A-Babies versus X-Babies, a joke comic that has good art, but is not to be taken too seriously. I think this one, that one is just, we're just watching a game. It's the, you know, they are fighting over a little Bucky teddy bear, I think, is the premise. And we're just watching that fight play out. And it's mostly, haha, look at the baby version of fill in your... So this one, you know, we do, like Aldo said, we see some pathos from Spider-Ham. We see him grow and we see how he is a positive influence on his world because they do name their big fight the Apocalypse. So I think that's our floor. That's my opinion that A-Babies versus X-Babies is the floor and this goes above that. How much higher I leave up to you. I think it goes higher, probably higher than you would put it, but now I'm looking closer at this list and I don't know how much higher it can go.
Here's the thing. I actually don't hate that as a floor. Because I do think that despite my ambivalence towards the story, it's got to be better than A-Babies versus X-Babies. And maybe not by much, but I do think it's at least a little better. because A Babies versus X Babies is where it is almost exclusively due to the strength of the art.
Yeah.
Which was really good. But yeah, A Babies versus X Babies is at number 103. My ceiling, I'm just going to throw this out there, Annihilation is at number 90. I think Annihilation has got to be better. And it probably, I'm actually not sure that it goes much lower than that, though, because, I mean, it's probably better than that Chris Claremont anniversary special, right?
Yeah.
We're in the neighborhood. I liked that special, but yeah, this was a tighter story and kind of like a greatest hits package.
Yeah. And as much as I like the Spider-Ham doing his little fourth wall break, he does not possess the corpse of a celestial to use as a ghostwriter.
Yeah,
that's the final host,
yeah.
Number 93. Yeah, is that it? This might be one of the easiest rankings we've ever done.
Yeah, let's do it.
So this would be the new number 94, going in between the final host and the Chris Claremont anniversary special.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Black Cat. What was this trade collection called, Aldo?
Grand Theft Marvel.
Grand Theft Marvel? That's a stupid title.
It is.
Okay, I found one bad thing to say about the book. Goes higher.
It does, much... I want to say much higher, but I don't know how much more higher.
So I immediately scrolled up to like number 40, The Oath. And I'm like, it's probably not as good as The Oath, the Doctor Strange story.
No.
So like it definitely goes higher, but let's not get too ambitious.
All right. I was thinking 35, which is where Daredevil Yellow is. I thought they were comparable, but that one feels more like, you know, we're relating an important part of the history of the character and not, let's see what shenanigans Felicia Hardy gets up to.
Yeah, I think by the end of this book, like the whole 12-issue run, it probably could, but it doesn't really have a lot of history. Granted, it's also a new book, so there's that.
I would put it right after The Oath, because I liked it better than Black Bolt Hard Time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was pretty good, but it's more fun.
I probably wouldn't go that high still, because like In Pursuit of Flight is at number 46, which that's a story I really like. But at the same time, this is kind of comparable to that. It's like In Pursuit of Flight was the first Captain Marvel title that Carol Danvers headlined. And again, a character that kind of didn't have a great history, didn't have a great track record, mostly due to the mismanagement by the creators who handled her, getting this chance to kind of break out, do her own thing, be her own person. So they are like really comparable. I just happen to like In Pursuit of Flight a little bit better personally. I probably would put this above Karnak though. So like I'm not going to fight you too hard on this. I would say I would personally put it at 48.
I remember one of my complaints about In Pursuit of Flight being the Dexter Soy art. It's really good. It's interesting, but it's not. I just don't jive with it too much.
Yeah, I like it. But that's pure subjectivity, right?
I would put this above that.
Yeah, same.
All right. I will accept the verdict of the court, you buttheads.
That's really funny. You buttheads is actually the last thing that we have on record in most Supreme Court cases nowadays.
to be fair, though, I would also put it just above Forget Me Not.
Oh.
Yeah, I would too. Forget Me Not's interesting, but then it comes down to which would you rather read?
This one, yeah. And Orphans of X was really good. Like, better than I thought it was going to be. So that's a bit of a hard ceiling on that one.
Yeah, it's beneath World War Hulk. And I think I can live with that. As much as, you know, this is a good story. World War Hulk is a story that I cannot stop thinking about still. I don't know why. Nope, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of Planet Hulk.
You are.
And whatever. This is comparable with World War Hulk. Still better than... Anyway, yeah. Cool. Okay, number 44. Between Orphans of X and Forget Me Not, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Cool. So that wraps up another episode. Our next discussion is going to be... these are two stories that have like nothing to do with each other. We're going to read the Mark Russell Fantastic Four Life Story series. We read the Spider-Man Life Story and quite liked it. It'll be interesting to see Fantastic Four get the same treatment. Freaking Mark Russell is such an interesting creator. I'm very, very curious to see what this looks like. I didn't know that this existed. I didn't know that he was the writer. Oof, very, very curious. We're going to follow that up with Darkhawk 2021 series. I know nothing about the character Darkhawk. I had the trading card back in the day. Never read a Darkhawk comic. I just had the card. Darkhawk is really good in Marvel Snap. That's all I got. I look forward to learning a thing about the character.
And I think just I'll happily wade through the history of the character, because I think this is not the original Darkhawk. I think this is someone else takes the mantle. It's one of those characters where I think the thing that gives you power also kind of corrupts you. And yeah. I also, yeah, didn't know the character very well. So I was like, well, let's take a gander and let's see what they're like.
All right. Well, we'll find out next time.
Yeah.
We will.
We sure will. When we read these books and then talk about them and then put them on an arbitrary list again.
Any meta in Marvel Snap where Darkhawk decks are viable is a meta I'm happy with.
What does he do in Snap?
So in Marvel Snap, Darkhawk has zero power, but he has an ongoing ability where he gets +2 power for every card in your opponent's deck.
Oh, so he's Rorschach in the prison.
That's not a, you know, a little...